This podcast is part of the Big Heads Media Podcast Network. Go to bigheadsmedia.com for more great podcasts.
Big on America.
You will never find the more wretched hive of scum and villainy.
Proof the deep state is real in America.
The media said what? Ha!
Patently false fake news.
Your organization's terrible.
This is the kind of thing that just tickles my balls.
Want to have a rousing discussion about truth, honor, patriotism?
The end of the republic has never looked better.
Be fighting the power, talking about social issues, politics, you know what I'm saying?
Three punches.
I enjoy Big Hoss.
And I'm smoking my cigar, of course.
Am I allowed to talk?
No, not right now.
You crazy Dutch bastard.
Monkey, you're getting a bit upset here.
Monkey, you can edit.
My favorite podcast.
Take names, take ass.
There's no going back. You've changed things forever.
Get in trouble. Good trouble. Necessary trouble.
Now you see that evil will always triumph because good is dumb.
Big on America.
Well, well, well. You dirty birds. Wait a minute. You can't be dirty birds because birds aren't real.
Yeah, oh, man, I forgot. Yeah. Surveillance systems.
Yeah, the only birds that are real in Irish Swede's world are a blue jay.
Are a blue jay.
Right. Those are, and they're not real either. They're actually a basketball team.
Yes.
Referring to the Creighton Blue Jays in the Sweet 16. This is Jason Dutch. This is Dig on America. I am here with a friend of the show, Irish Swede. Mikey is off for personal reasons, which I'll let him talk about. Many of you already know. Big Hoss is off because he's, I don't know, mowing his lawn. And Anna has legitimate excuses to be off because she's her last day at the job, I believe, is today. So she's moving. So I believe Anna will be absent for this week and next week. But in the meantime, you get me. So if you are watching on the Dutch Jason Twitch channel, that's great. If you'd like to come over to the Dig on America Twitch channel, you can do that. At least maybe by the time we raid out. So probably a little bit of a shorter show tonight. I'm here with Irish Swede. So Irish Swede, for those who don't know you, go ahead and introduce yourself to the team.
Let's see here. I guess I'm part of the economics team here on the DOA. So I've been doing in some sort of economic position for the last 21 years now.
A couple days.
Yeah. Work in the investment banking securities arena. Was a large loan officer for a bank for a couple of years in there, mostly PE, VC, and capital markets. So my company depends upon me and making forecasts and all that fun stuff. So it's got my master's in econ finance and am actually going to be thinking about doing a master's in studies of legal studies or master's of science of legal studies in securities law here pretty quick too, depending on how next week goes. If anybody knows me, then they know I love surgeries.
And I was gonna say, man, like I we always invite you out to the club and you're like, nah, I think I'm just gonna go have the doctor cut my head open, you know. I need an implant.
Yeah, well, you know, last Thursday was this one, or last January was this one. That was a carotid to subclavian bypass, and my follow-up CT for that is Monday. where I find out if I have to do a full thoracoabdominal incision, total aortic replacement. So,
and this is the, if my memory serves, the same thing that took John Ritter from us. Is that correct?
Correct.
Yeah. Is there any truth to the rumor that you're making this all up and you're just turning yourself into an android?
I am technically a cyborg. I do have a mechanical heart valve. So,
Okay. So the next DC movie, go check it out. Starring Irish Swede as himself.
Yeah.
He fits the part. Here's the good part, Irish Swede. If you are the next big superhero movie, icon, it won't trigger like Matt Walsh or like Nerdrotic or all these right wingers, because you're just, as usual, as should always be the case, only white men fall into the vat of radioactive material and get superpowers. If anyone else falls into the vat, it's unrealistic and woke, as you know.
Of course. Yeah.
Yes. So
it's a lot like the drag shows that everybody complains about, but then they walk and take their kids to a basketball game where the dance team, does their thing on the floor, and that's okay.
Yeah. Or Hooters.
Yeah.
I don't see any protests outside of Hooters. No. TB Cookies is asking, where did you get your master's? Creighton University. Yep. He got it from, look, TB Cookies. He's on the left. He got it. He bought it from George Soros. Okay. we all know he doesn't, none of us really does. We know really no history. None of us know anything.
This is not a lie right here.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just George Soros had that made. He bought it on eBay for 16 cents. Soros is like, oh, you're part of my world domination cult. Let's get this going. So we're going to talk about economics today. So if you are watching on Twitch, especially if you're watching on the Dutch Jason channel, this show is a little bit different. This is more of a podcast format. So if you subscribe or follow or something like that, I can't tell. I don't know, because I don't get the notifications in this studio. But this studio makes it a little bit easier for me to grab the audio and do all that other stuff that we do, like for Spotify and iTunes. So if you do sub, just post in there. Just, hey, I just subbed, and then I'll be happy to thank you. So Irish Swede, before we get started, four down territory. I will ask you four questions. We haven't played this in a while, so I'm excited to do this. I will ask you four questions. You will give me four answers. You've played this game before, so you know the rules. Actually, I'll let you pick your poison. Do you want to play snap one, or do you want to play four down territory?
We'll do four down.
Okay. All right. So of the teams in the Creighton is in which conference now? I've heard they used to be in the MVC, but they're not anymore.
Big East.
They're in the Big East. Oh, okay. They're in the Big East now. Which Big East team would you support to win the national championship if it couldn't be Creighton?
Oh, that's easy, because I grew up watching St. John's, who now has a coach
basketball team since Felipe Lopez left.
So, which is funny, because Rick Pitino is their coach now. So they actually have a coach.
Yeah, but has he started buying players like normal yet, or is he not?
Well, now it's legal. That's what NIL stands for. Now it's legal.
Good old Rick Pitino. All right, so St. John's. All right, first question knocked out. What is the oldest electronics item that you have in your house that you still use?
So it has to be like battery operated or something?
No, I mean, like, maybe it's an old VCR or something like that. Who knows?
Or it has to, because my Nikon f-stop probably film camera probably doesn't. Well, I mean, it has batteries, so I guess that. I mean, it's the 1970s.
And you're still using it?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I mean, a camera counts. Yeah, so it probably gets better. It's probably is it like a DSLR or DLR.
It's DSLR, or yeah. It's mirrored. Yep.
Oh, yeah, so it probably gets better. Crisper photos than these.
And the nice thing is all the lenses from the 70s are actually really nice and still work with all the mounts for today.
Yeah, they definitely made things better in the 60s and 70s, 50s and 60s and 70s than they do now. You know, mass production has been good for cheap goods, and China's been good for cheap goods, and we'll get into economics later. But, you know, like, especially like clothing, like, you know, and like air conditioners, really everything. The air conditioner that we had in our house when we moved into our house was there since 1997. It was still going strong. We replaced it because we were worried it was going to go out in the middle of summer, but it really wasn't. But I mean, it was 20 something years old, right? So it was a responsible thing to do 26 years later to replace it. But I know for a fact that the new one that the, you know, person who owns that house now has, even though it's only 6 months old, it's probably not going to last any more than 7 or 8 years. They just don't.
I don't know, but like when you talk about lenses and things, today the multifocal, so you're like your 14 to 24 millimeter lenses, ones that you can zoom, are way better than they were 70 years ago. The fixed focals from 70 years ago are way better than they are today. So if you, because there's a lens out there, there's a 0.95 aperture 50 millimeter lens out there from Nikon that they just couldn't replicate today. Well, they could, but it just wouldn't be just as good. The glap, however, the CA color aberration and the corners and the corner distortion and everything is near zero on that 14 to 24 millimeter lens. And that's like saying something, you know, because you've got that ultra, ultra wide lens. And then today, the tilt shift mounts that you have for lenses. You don't know what a tilt shift is. If you ever seen a picture that makes like a train look like a toy train.
Yes. Those are like, second thought has those. Like they play, like those are the trippiest thing. Like a lot of different YouTube channels use those. It's like, how do they make real life look like a 1957 Japanese Godzilla movie?
Go look at how tilt shift lenses work.
Maybe I will do that. Is that what they're called?
I don't think I can explain it very well because I have never really played with them because that's not the type of photography I'm into. But tilt shift lenses are really, really cool, especially when somebody knows how to use one.
Interesting. Okay, pushing forward. Question number three. I usually don't get to pick all three or all four questions, so this is nice. It's 10 p.m. So were you not after this podcast is over, you're feeling a little hungry. You open the cabinet. There's cereal. You have the cereal craving. What's your late night cereal of choice?
Granola.
So granola, like
raisins.
Ah, okay. So is it like grape nuts type granola or just no. Like actual granola and you're putting actual it in granola. Milk?
Yep.
And are you putting it in milk or are you eating it dry?
A little bit of milk, enough to get everything just a teeny bit wet. You don't drown granola in milk.
I get the Simply granola from Quaker. But I usually don't eat it by itself. I'll like sprinkle it on like Frosted Flakes or yogurt or I'll put it in Frosted Flakes or yogurt or ice cream or, you know, a lot of different stuff. And like, I also have this keto granola that's really good. It's mostly coconut. It's like coconut and pumpkin seed and pecans and like, like little soy cubes or something like that. I'm not sure what exactly they are, but, it's very, very good, but I'll generally like sprinkle it on. I don't just eat it by itself.
If it's got raisins, I can eat it by itself. If it doesn't, I don't think I can.
Yeah. I'm not a raisin guy. Okay. Let's see. One.
I was a raisin guy until I fed too many of them to my youngest child.
Voltarian says it's great seeing the Swede. Yes, it is. Okay. I got to come up with one more question for Swede here. Let's see. You know, we'll go with an old tried but true since we're talking about breakfast cereal. 1980s, 1990s, I'm guessing you were a kid. Probably the 80s.
Born in 80.
You're born in 80, okay. The Saturday morning cartoon that most identifies your youth. Like, what was the Saturday morning cartoon you remember the most watching as a kid? Back when cartoons were only on one or two days a week.
Probably Looney Tunes. Yeah, I think Bugs Bunny and then Garfield and Friends. Garfield and Friends was one of my favorites.
Okay, so I have to ask a follow-up question now, and then we'll get to the top. Hey, Crazy Catnip, you are on time. Garfield versus Heathcliff, who wins? Death match.
What's the prize?
if
you say lasagna, you know exactly.
A date with Scooby-Doo. I don't know.
I think both would not show up.
They'd both chicken out. So Scooby-Doo would just be sitting there by himself waiting. Mm-hmm. Poor
Scooby. Like if you said the first place was a plate of lasagna, Garfield, no question.
Well, yeah, of course. That'd be cheating, though. He'd have extra motivation.
If you said the first place is being able to send Nermal all the way to Abu Dhabi.
Well, and Heathcliff was like very much into like scantily dressed lady cats. So like he was more of a womanizer. So if it was like a piece of kitty, he would definitely, no pun intended on that one. You know, Heathcliff then would have motivation. Garfield didn't care about the women. He cared about the food. Heathcliff cared about like the mischief.
Yeah.
But all right.
And so, he hated Nermal.
I don't remember who Nermal was. That was the one with the beanie hat, like the fedora type hat.
No. Nermal was the perfect lady cat that basically annoyed Garfield by being too perfect.
Oh, and Garfield. Okay, yep. That's why I wasn't thinking about it. That's why I couldn't think of it. Okay. You tricked me. All right. I don't even remember there being a lady cat in Garfield. I just remember Odie. Odie, yep. and John was the owner's name, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
John Arbuckle.
Did you ever read Dilbert?
I read Dilbert quite a bit. It was a formative comic for me through most of my cubicle days.
Yeah.
You used to love it. Now it happens to go into the bin of great comics that have crap writers.
Did you notice over the years, like a shift in like the way that he was writing that comic book in the last few, or that strip, in the last few years? Did all this come as a surprise to you, or did you kind of always know that he was?
When he started rationalizing Trump in 2016 for the kind of madness of method that Trump was throwing against the wall and who he was trying to appeal to, it was pretty clear at that point things would go downhill from there. That's really about the time I started paying attention to a lot of, at least my shift to the left was about that period of time. And noticing flat out, you know, the manosphere, which he was definitely a big part of, it was pretty evident at that point. Before that, I don't think I really looked.
Did we lose? What happened there? Something.
I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know what happened there either. I see what happened. My internet. I moved my microphone. I had the audacity to move my microphone. Mm. Whatever the StreamYard decided that I had gone a bridge too far. All right. So
no more Market Garden for you.
No, yeah, apparently not. So don't worry, microphone, I won't touch you. I'll let you just sit there and you know, be unmolested. All right, so economics. So as most of you who have not been hiding under a rock know, over the course of the last couple of weeks, banking has been in the news, right? So this story has been up, down. It's been left, right. There's been a lot of criticism from both the right and the left. There's been a lot of talk about whether it was a bailout, whether it wasn't a bailout. I've talked about this quite a bit on my Twitch channel, basically from just observing the story at first to listening to different people's opinions, different economists who, you know, have had different opinions on stuff. A lot of very rich people who seem to be very much in favor of this. Don't call it a bailout. I've been here for years. The one thing that I think about the SVB crash and the aftermath of it that I think was the most eyebrow raising to me was the immediate political backlash in two different ways. Number one was the right wing seemed to love it because it was in Silicon Valley. Let the all go woke, go broke mentality. And number two was a lot of very, very rich people started saying, hey, bail them out, bail them out, bail them out. Going back to like the initial collapse of the bank and the 2 or 3 days after that, what was going through your mind? What were you observing? What were you seeing? What was your reactions?
Well, my hope was that it wasn't a bailout, and it wasn't. A bailout for at least for us would have been where the equity holders would have been made whole. And they were not. The equity holders are wiped out. Whoever picks up the obligations with the assets on the books, usually for no cost, it'll just be, they'll just pick up the obligations and go, like assuming a loan on a house. And that's basically your purchase price. That's kind of what it is. But depositors were guaranteed, mainly because, and I thought that was a good thing, and still do mostly, mainly because depositors were kind of duped into thinking that things were a little bit rosier than they were at the time, especially with where deposits and how lending practices were being done. You had high risk loans getting 400 basis point, you know, interest charge in an environment where you can get risk free for 350 to 500. And so you're already upside down instantly on loans being gone out the door. So you had this weird institution that was given sweetheart deals on one side, depositors not playing that game, or not being in charge of playing that game, being backstopped, which is what we would call it. And a lot of businesses, you know, like Roku had what, 500 million?
Yeah, I think it was four, just under five. It was from what I had seen. And you know, like that makes no sense to me. How do you have all of your money for your entire company in one account? That can't be.
It probably wasn't one. It probably wasn't just that. That was probably just their major in and out, you know, business transaction, APAR. Account. It's really, really hard to go through a sweep account and be able to be instantly liquid like they maybe may or may not need to be with that 500 million.
There was a
and even with a really good sweep account, you're only getting 10 million FDIC insured.
So the way that I understand this is one of the arguments that I have been with criticism. In fact, I think it was a Crystal Ball, I think, or maybe it was Anna Kasparian who was saying, you know, don't be gaslit and thinking this wasn't a bailout. And I was like, well, maybe am I thinking about this wrong? Am I giving too much benefit of the doubt here? And I was like, and I went through and I thought about it, and I'm like, okay, so I'm kind of split on whether or not it was a bailout, because I want to say it's not a bailout because it literally wasn't a bailout of the bank. That bank does not exist anymore. So therefore, by definition, it cannot be a bailout of the bank. And anyone who says it is lying to you. However, I am interested in the argument of who the particular depositors were in this particular bank and like where, what their economic status was. You know, companies like Roku essentially did get bailed out. You know, company people who had, you know, $40, $50, $60 million in that bank essentially did get bailed out. There were some tech startups. Now, I am also all for the notion that up to a certain dollar amount, we want companies who are not really at fault with this to be able to make their payroll, you know, the week after, right? And make sure that people who work there and have nothing to do with this and are just going into work every day and working as like maybe an engineer or, you know, semiconductor manufacturers or whoever, you know, guys working on the CNC machine, these guys, I want these guys to be able to get their paychecks. So I'm kind of torn on that. But what would you say to someone who says, oh, no, this was a bailout? You're allowing the Biden administration to gaslight you.
A bailout for us, at least.
Thank you for this, the raid, H.R. Johnson. And thank you for saying raid, HR. I love you so much. Because as she knows, I am on StreamYard and I can't see that there was a raid. So thank you. Welcome in HR Johnson's viewers.
For there to be a bailout, risks would have had to have been taken, overages of risks. Now you can say the $500 million within one institution would be an overage of risk, but you don't know the particular circumstances. And these are time deposits. These are supposed to be low risk, you know, easy cash, liquid ways for a business to be able to conduct, you know, their inflows, outflows, capital accounts, capital investments, payroll, AP, AR, your basic AP, AR, which is accounts payable, accounts receivable. And so it wasn't like Roku was, you know, out buying speculative investments and trying to make, you know, up for mistakes made in the past or anything like that. So to say it's a bailout would be equating it to bailing out, let's see, which would, you know, JP Morgan, who made a lot of speculative investments within that, you know, framework of the 2007, 8, 9 real estate market. It's a false equivalency. It really is. You know, comparing those two situations.
Explain to the uninitiated what makes it a false equivalency.
Well, JP Morgan got a bailout and the equity holders were made whole, even though they took excessive risks back in the Great Recession. Today, Roku is just depositing their money in a time deposit account, which for us, you and I, that's the safest place that we can put a dollar today. Other than your mattress. So it's a...
the two depends on whose house the mattress is at, though.
Yeah, true. But it's a false equivalence. You can't say that JP Morgan getting bailed out money or Morgan, you know, getting Morgan Stanley or Merrill Lynch or Wells Fargo or anybody else who got money to prop up their equity owners, that's the same as the Silicon Valley Bank situation in which depositors are just make, you know, just being backstopped. They're not getting excess money. They're not getting, you know, they didn't technically lose money by a speculation investment.
Right.
So it's nowhere near the same.
Okay. So I'm going to play devil's advocate for you here. I am not pretending that I am advocating for either of these positions. I'm just passing on arguments that I've heard from people that I generally would listen to, right? So one would be is that the Fed has mechanisms in place to rectify these types of situations already. And that, you know, after liquefying the bank and selling off assets and all of those processes that take place after a failure of a bank, that most of the depositors of the bank would have taken a little haircut, maybe to 5 to 15%, depending on the entity. Of course, anyone over 250,000, which that first 250 is fully guaranteed. And that mechanism should have been allowed to play out.
It did.
So explain how that played out when they.
So when Silicon Valley Bank went into receivership, whoever is going to take on whatever bank is going to buy them, they're just going to take on all the deposits, all the assets, and all the liabilities thereof. And just it's going to be a cashless transaction. They're just going to take it on. Mm-hmm. And there's going to be no write downs. And if there were any write downs within any of that, which is that small haircut, that's where the backstop comes in. However, most of that back, any real need for that is gone, mainly because of the confidence of the Treasury Department stepping in and saying, we're backstopping it.
Okay, so let me ask you this. How does that process specifically take place? Because this is something that I don't know. So when you deposit, I'll tell you what I know. And then I think probably what Jason Dutch knows, my guess is that it's relatively common knowledge, maybe a little bit or above par for a normal Joe Schmo on the street. Right. So fill in the gaps for me and for the listeners, as to any other information based, you know, that would fill that delta between what I'm about to say and what you just said about, you know, the new bank coming in and having that money. It seems like what you said is that money basically would still kind of be there. Mm-hmm. So when entity X or person X deposits money into a bank, that money goes into the bank. The bank then can use that money to invest or, you know, give out loans or whatever. There's I forget the term but there's a term there that you'll probably throw at me where, you know, there's a certain amount of money that they can loan out.
Fractional underbanking.
Right. Thank you. To based on the amount of deposits that they have on a given day. Right. And that dollar amount fluctuates from day to day. So when a bank
doesn't anymore, there's a 0% reserve requirement.
So what I learned in economics in the 1990s is no longer relevant.
As of 2017, there's a 0% reserve requirement.
Okay. So if a bank has $1,000 in deposits, in the old days, they used to be able, they will give out what, like $2,000 in loans or something like that. I don't know.
Depends on what the reserve requirement was. I mean, if it was 5%, they could loan out $950, have that as booked as AR, have 5% of that, and then it goes on down the list, you know, as far as
the idea was they'd still have some money in their coffers to give people who are closing their account or want to withdraw money from the ATM.
But as of 2017, the banking system recognized that money creation at the Fed level only doesn't make a lot of sense. And you need a more decentralized money creation system for regional and localized banking systems. So if Seattle, Washington has a different set of economic circumstances than San Francisco, either the Fed districts or the local banks themselves can actually decide based on the risk profiles where to create the money. It's a much more decentralized system now. Now it's a lot harder to regulate because the OCC, along with the Fed, trying to make sure that these banks don't go, you know, hog wild in money creation, is quite the problem, especially when this happens. You're on mute.
Yeah. So just real quick, there was one article I wanted to bring. I'm going to kind of circle back for a little bit here because there's an article that I pulled up. There's an article here from The Atlantic, and I'm not going to read the entire thing, but I will just very briefly go over a little bit of it. It says it's from someone named Michael Grunwald. It says, yes, Silicon Valley Bank was bailed out. So what? So I'm just going to kind of give you the first two paragraphs here. It says, the article starts out and says, it doesn't seem fair. Just 15 years after our financial overlords went on a bailout binge, showering bankers with trillions of taxpayer dollars, they're once again riding to the rescue of the rich while the public watches in horror. Did they learn none of the lessons from the 2008 meltdown? Actually, yes, they did. The government's financial crisis managers clearly studied the lessons of 08, which is one reason the collapse of Silicon Valley Bank a week ago doesn't seem to have created another cataclysm. So at least so far. It's the public that's never understood those lessons, which is one reason the public is likely to draw the wrong conclusions about the SVB mess too. And the most important lesson is the hardest to understand. Good financial crisis management isn't supposed to seem fair. What would be your response to that? Is that an accurate characterization? Is that oversimplification that it seems to me to be? What are your thoughts?
Well, I mean, I don't know what other people seem fair, but when I sit back and I look at the equity holders getting wiped out for taking risks, you know, taking equity like risks and hoping to get equity like returns, but getting zeroed out, that's fair to me. If you take $1,000 and throw it at a startup and fully realizing that tomorrow it could go out of business, that's the risk, and that's the risk the equity owners took. If there was an understanding of the amount of risk that they were taking and the sweetheart deals that they were writing amongst the VC community, I don't think they would have had as many deposits. That's kind of where when we're looking at it from a transparency issue, that there wasn't a lot of transparency into what type of paper they were writing. You get into some of the details and you can find that there were loans being written to venture capital companies that should have been charging anywhere between 11 to 14% on money, because that's the risk that venture capital is. When you lend money like that, that's the type of interest rate you're charging. They were writing that paper at 4%.
Is it the same for private equity firms that, you know, they come in and flip companies?
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. The LBOs can be anywhere between 8 to 15.
Really?
Yep.
So that was the cheap money and is the cheap, because, you know, even based on those numbers, even the rates today, which people are calling high, are still cheap money compared to what you just said.
That is rates today.
Well, rates right now are the Fed rate today is what, 4.5%
Yeah.
So like, wouldn't that be the same rate that, the way that I understand it, a bank would take that rate, add, you know, a point onto it or something like that, and then that would be the rate that they would.
Well, that would be a rate you would give to somebody at a 50% loan to value on a hard asset that has residual value, not to a venture capital company that it has intellectual property that may or may not be worth something after the company goes under. And on a whim and a prayer, and maybe some personal guarantees for a portion of it from either angels or the backers. It's completely the two different risk profiles. So you and I, when we go to the bank and we get our mortgage today for what, 6.5, which is 250 over prime or 250 over the Fed rate. When I say 250, that's basis points. 1 basis point is 1/100th of 1%. So 250 would be 2.5%. So Fed rate is 400. You go get your loan, your mortgage at 250, at 650. That's a 250 spread. That's how the bank makes money, essentially. Either that or they're taking in deposits. They're paying the depositors between 2 and 2.75%. Because you got to pay your employees and everything too, so you can't pay them the 4. And so you've got this what we call PPNR, pre-provision net revenue, of 2.5.
Pre-provision net revenue.
Yep, pre-provision. Okay. So your provision is for your bad debt, your write-offs.
Okay.
So your 2.5 is your pre-provision net revenue on all the money that you have out the door. And you just made me lose my spot. Darn it. But here's where that money gives.
My bad.
Is you have that money went to you with a house. That real estate, they can reasonably assume, A, your job is going to be around and you're going to be able to pay it because, A, it's your house and people pay their, you know, mortgages first. But in lack of that, we lent to a house that we reasonably believe that will retain its value and we'll be able to at least get the vast majority of that back. That goes out the door when you're lending to VC companies. There, you're looking at a 400 Fed rate, and the average spread over that is between 700 and 900 over Fed rate.
Okay. So this doesn't seem to be exactly the same as like when I think of lending. So let me break this down in a way that I think most people kind of know how this works. And then you can kind of guide me as to where the inherent differences are here. Cause I can tell there's a difference, but you know, in order to make it make sense to my brain, my ADHD brain is a little bit different. Most other people may already have caught on or could be just as confused as me. So like when I was in the automobile sales, right, we would buy, you would have a person, they'd have a certain amount of money for down payment. The car would have a certain value, right? So depending on the amount of LTV, loan to value ratio of that particular loan, they would qualify for a certain rate. Now the dealership would then take that rate, you know, let's say it was from Capital One and they were buying it at 5% just for shits and giggles. They might sell it to the customer and pass it on to the customer at 6%, right? And Capital One was buying that money from, the way that I understand it, from the Fed at really next to no interest rate, depending on the time frame in which that loan took place. First of all, is that a fair characterization?
Well, you're also getting it from depositors. And at that time, you know, 2017, 18, 19, 20, they were paying depositors nothing.
Right. When you say they're paying depositors nothing, what exactly are you referring to?
Well, when you went and deposited your money in 2019, what was the interest rate you were
getting? Right. Okay. That's what I thought you were saying, but I wasn't sure I was on the right. Okay. So yeah, because most checking accounts don't have an interest rate, you know, savings accounts, interest rates are what, like 2-3%, you know?
E-Trade, you can get, I think, 3.75 now.
And that's one of the, and that's another thing that I'll circle back to, because there was some conversation about how Silicon Valley Bank had higher interest rate accounts for some of these tech startups. I'm not sure how big of to me that seems relatively benign. You know, in order to compete with Chase, which is what, 20 times bigger than they are, they have to have something that's shiny for the person to say, hey, I'm going to go there and do my business there instead, in order for them to capture that business, right? So in the example of the car loan that I gave you, and I know this is probably similar with the mortgage and that sort of stuff, is it fair to say that like Capital One or Chase or whoever was funding that car loan to the dealership that again went to the consumer, that they were borrowing that money from the Fed at close to 0%, if not at 0%.
Well, that's the overnight rate. That's the whatever the overnight rate was at the time.
Which is generally like what on a given
today
day?
It's 4%.
Okay. And like maybe during the internet boom of the 90s.
Most of your and I adult life, it's been zero.
Okay. So that was relatively accurate then. Then it is close to zero. Or actually zero.
Yeah. For regional banks. So like First National Bank of Omaha is a major national bank that actually runs the Fed window for some of the smaller, more regional and state charter banks. and they'll charge a quarter point on the Fed funds that are 0.2 FNBO. So they're a conduit for the small banks. So like Cattlemen's Bank is a tiny bank in central Nebraska that does primarily work with cattle ranchers. They go to the Fed window in Omaha, not, you know, the, at the Fed itself.
Okay, I see what you're saying.
And for that service, FNBO charges a quarter point overnight.
Gotcha. Okay. And how often, Swede, for those of us who don't pay attention, and I think that a lot of, for a lot of us, unfortunately, you know, a great example I think here is Norfolk Southern. You know, now everybody and their grandma knows that we have hundreds of derailments a year. They may just not cause chemical leaks that go into the air and pollute tap, you know, water and kill people's pets. So now everyone knows about that. But 2 months ago, very few people knew about it outside of the rail industry. And they didn't really pay attention to, you know, the rollbacks that Trump did in 2018 or the provisions that Obama tried to put forward in 2015. Is it similar in banking where like banks, you know, I was looking up some of the historical data on this. It seems that banks fail relatively regularly. But, you know, you just don't hear about them because they're a smaller bank and like a Cattlemen's Bank. And when they fail, they generally don't, it doesn't make the news. It just gets bought by another bank before they go into, you know, complete chaos. Yeah. Usually
FNBO would go, oh, Cattlemen's is in trouble. Many of their clients are already our clients too, you know, on the big loans that they do. And so we'll just eat them up.
Right. And that's why you see banks switch names very frequently, right?
Correct.
Is there a big difference in people's security of their money between having it in like Bank of America and a Cattlemen's Bank or their local credit union?
Credit union's completely different animal. Credit unions, that's they have, you know, they have their own FDIC, which is the same level and everything else. You will have, I guess a good argument could be made that like your money would be safer at the large nationals than say your local. However, if your local is run really well, you're not going to see much trouble. It's where the locals get into trouble is when they start reaching.
Okay. And
you're not going to know that until after it's already too late. But if you know your bank president and you know what kind of paper they're writing and what kind of asset coverage that they're requiring for borrowers, and that asset coverage is good, you know, if you're making a farmer who wants to buy, you know, another 1,000 acres, you know, pledge their other 2,000 acres on top of it, you know, you got a smart banker on your hands.
Yeah. And there was actually a quote that I pulled up, that was regarding SVB, which I guess you could characterize, they weren't really a small bank, probably like Cattlemen's, but they were, you know, they're a California state chartered bank. They had branches overseas, you know, other places within the United States. So they weren't like, you know, super tiny. But there does seem to be some agreement on the line of thought that they were an outlier because of their confluence of risks, you know, having money in, you know, a lot of government bonds. And then, you know, when the Fed raised interest rates, that those bonds became essentially worth less money. And that, you know, if you listen to Tucker Carlson, of course, who, you know, knows everything after it happened, weeks before it happened, we should have seen this coming long before. What are the signs that people missed?
So where this, most of this came from and why Silicon actually, you want to know why it actually failed. The reason the failure happened is most of those deposits, they were making their spread off of the government bond rate versus what they were paying depositors. So they would take depositor money and not only would they give loans, but they would go buy treasuries. which is great thing. Treasuries are generally
really stable, right?
Very stable. However, as all bonds do, when rates go up, bond prices go down. That's usually not a problem because you don't have to mark those bonds until you sell them.
And you can list them as, but you can list them, I believe, as worth what you paid for them on your balance sheet.
Yeah, because they're held to maturity.
And that inflates your assets though, doesn't it?
Depending on the risk level you're taking in treasuries and how much of your assets are in there. When your assets get too high in there and there is a bank run and you have to sell, then turn around and sell those assets. Now you can, like, you buy a two-year bond for $1,000. Interest rates go up. The market value of your bond went down, but if you hold it for 2 years, you're going to get your $1,000 back.
Right.
You're just going to get a less of an interest rate than other people are getting who bought it, you know, who put their money in later. It's the seesaw of interest rates go up, bond prices go down, you know, and the opposite is true. That'll be
your 7 test. So like most larger banks, from what I understand,
the thought is to say Silicon Valley Bank had an excessive amount in treasuries. And when they needed to go sell those, they had to realize all of those losses on what they sold. And when they did that, their capitalization disappeared.
So, because it's only if you have to sell it.
If they didn't have that bank run and didn't have to sell those assets.
Right.
They would have just held those things to maturity, and as they matured, would have, you know, taken the par value in and then rebought treasuries as a higher rate.
Okay. That confirms what I thought I had understood, that basically it was only a loss once you sold it. So, and in this case, because they kind of advertised that they wanted to sell, you know, that they were trying to sell these off and that people kind of caught wind of it. The fear was, hey, there's going to be a bank run here.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Okay. And how often does something like this happen to these smaller banks?
Very rarely. Most bank failures come from a series of loans that shouldn't have been made.
Or
from conflating circumstances such as the 1987 farm crisis.
Well, that would be an example of non-woke failure. But in this case, Silicon Valley Bank did. It seems to me that they were really, really a pretty significant outlier. And, you know, the people who are kind of characterized this as woke goes broke. I don't know what was woke about them making money because they were highly capitalist. But nonetheless,
But they were also highly sector specific. So right. When one sector went a certain way.
But so was Cattlemen's. So
not necessarily, because they make a lot of home mortgages. They make, if you looked at their balance sheet, yes, their major singular clientele are cattle ranchers. But a lot of their major depositors are local major colleges, you know, the small religious colleges that dot our state.
Would you say, what would you say that like percent, cause, and I'm just trying to wrap my head around this, because when the bank first failed, Haas and I talked about a little bit last week, and we basically just regurgitated stuff that was online. Cause we didn't really have a chance to like dive into this yet, but from what I was able to glean, about 55 to 60% of the deposits at SVB were from venture capital firms or from private equity firms.
Correct.
Now, that does not necessarily mean it was tech specific, but when you leave that, when you look but at that other VC 45 specific, what's that?
It's VC specific, which is highly volatile.
VC,
venture capital.
Oh, venture capital. Okay. But venture capital is not necessarily tech related. You can have venture capital in.
But it's as far as startups. as far as a risk sector, VCPE is its own animal.
Okay, so it really didn't have much to do with the fact that it was tech. It had to do with it was the type of business, and that type of business in this case
and where
happened to be tech more often than not.
and where in the business cycle they were. They're very early stage VC and extreme highly levered LBO PE.
You're going to need to give us that acronym.
PE is private equity. LBO is leveraged buyout.
Okay. Gotcha. All right. It's starting to make a little bit more sense now. So,
when you finance an LBO through a PE, a leveraged buyout, which means you're basically buying it all with leverage, you're 100% loan to book value on a company which may have zero physical assets.
Right. Okay. And in a lot of cases might lose money for the first few years that it's in business as well. Yep. Right. You know, so if you look at the Amazon model as being, you know, the most obvious example of that in the room, Disney Plus operating under that model right now, you know, Disney as a whole making money, but Disney Plus is losing money, which I think they expected, right? Because, you know, the same thing happened with HBO Max and all of these streaming services when they first start up. So I see what you're saying with that. I know we have limited time and I want to try to keep this to like maybe like an hour and a half at the top end. So I'm going to kind of push through. And if anyone has any questions in the chat, by all means. Hey, Mikey, what's up, buddy? Hope everything's going good with you and all the adventures taking place at the famine household. the famine taking place at the famine household. So is the Fed setting a precedent for now essentially bailing out any bank that fails, no matter how big it is? And let me just kind of characterize that question by, you know, kind of giving an example of what the arguments are that I've heard surrounding this. Banks pay in for the FDIC insurance. And anytime that I'm wrong with something, just correct me, because maybe I'm misunderstanding. My economics background is three classes from the 1990s, right?
This is an econ. This is just bank structuring.
Well, regardless of that, I took three economics classes in college, so I don't advertise myself as an economist, right? I read Marx's Communist Manifesto, so I guess that makes me an economics expert. So banks pay for the FDIC insurance of $250,000. So I'm guessing that they pay that. The fact that that insurance is capped at $250,000 is related to the amount of money that the banks would pay to the Fed for that insurance, to participate in that insurance program. But the argument around the campfire now seems to be that the banks were only paying for $250,000. And now essentially there's a precedent that that's an unlimited amount of money up to the $9 trillion that's in the U.S. banking system. Is that a fair characterization?
No.
Okay.
Explain no, because why. every individual bank failure will be tested on its own merit. So in the case of SVB, you've got an excessive amount and concentration of corporate monies that needed to be freed up and guaranteed backstopped to make payroll, to make your capital investment, to do that. And on top of that, they basically have now told all bank owners, equity holders, we aren't bailing you out. So there's going to be a completely different view from the equity holders.
It's a good point.
As far as the risk that they take. So when you take less risk, the OCC will come in and see how you're rating your own debt, see how you're marking your own loans, making sure you're doing FAS 5s on loans that you think are having problems. There's this whole...
What is FAS 5 other than the movie?
FAS 5 is the regulation that you have to remark loans that you think are maybe a little bit in trouble. And
when you say remark loans, you're talking about...
You have to reserve more against them.
Ah, okay, I see.
So gotcha. If your reserve requirement was 5%, now if you have to do a FAS 5 remarking of it, you may have to provision another 15%.
Okay.
So that then goes against your pre-provision net revenue, to what you get your net revenue from.
Gotcha.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. And so just to be very clear, it has nothing to do with Paul Walker, Vin Diesel, or Gal Gadot.
No.
Okay. Maybe Gal Gadot, but because I wanted to have something to do with Gal Gadot. All right. So, pushing forward again. So we've talked about this, whether or not this could set a precedent. One thing that I think is, an important question to ask is, do you believe, and there seems to be a lot of talk around the campfire from the anti-establishment camp, of which I'm a part, and I think you are as well, at least to a point. I don't want to presume to
say exactly what you know or believe. Yeah. So.
Right. So based on the fact that I knew you were an anarcho-capitalist, I figured you were anti-establishment.
Syndicalist. I am not a capitalist.
An anarcho...
syndicalist.
Did I say capitalist?
Yeah.
That's not the word that I meant to use, but okay. You are like an anarchist economist type of thing.
Anarcho-syndicalist.
I have not ever heard the word syndicalist before in my life. You said cynical or syndical? No,
syndical. The syndicate system.
Oh, okay. Gotcha. I had not heard that term before. Does that make me unique? Am I like the only one who hadn't heard that term? Okay.
It makes you the majority.
Okay. Well, now I'm in the minority because I've heard it. But when you look at like the, it's not unreasonable to look at the depositors for this bank and say, okay, on par, on average, it seems that they had a very well-to-do client list, right? When it came, now, of course, there were some Tom, Dick, and Harry's, and there were some people who had,
there's, you know, Gavin 2,000, Newsom.
8,000, you know, your Gavin Newsom's of the world. And, you know, you have people who, and obviously this is the reason why this became so politicized, because when you have, you know, Facebook and Gavin Newsom and Nancy Pelosi, you have accounts there. Of course, the right wing sees red meat whenever it wants to see red meat. And they're like, you know, and they start out with this narrative. But if Cattlemen's Bank failed, they would never talk about that because it would be their homegrown American, you know. And when those banks do fail, they ignore them completely. So we all know that it's just spin bullshit, right? We still have to be able to explain that to our parents and friends around the table who believe that narrative, right? So it's important to, you know, be able to have some counterpoints. But I also think it's reasonable to point out that I am unconvinced that the Fed would react the same way towards a bank that had, you know, a bunch like 10,000 depositors who the most wealthy of them was making $30 an hour. You know, like a bunch of union guys and that sort of stuff. Like, I highly doubt that. I just find it very unrealistic, Swede, that they would have treated it the same way if it were just working class people and not, you know, the elites, so to speak. Am I completely off base, or am I probably?
Every bank of SVIB's or SIVB's size has notable people as depositors. Period.
Okay. I'm not sure that's answering the question, though.
So you're not going to find, even Cattlemen's had some pretty notable depositors. So you're not going to find a bank except credit unions, because you have to be either a fraternal member or, you know, you have to be a military member or the child of a military member. You know, there's a lot of restrictions, you know, right. A lot of those. But even then, you're going to have notable, at least even local notables.
Right, but having a few local notables and having 60% of your depositors being local notables is a little different, right?
But you're in San Francisco. Who are your local notables? Google? Facebook?
Yeah. I mean, no, I believe me, I get that. It's just that I seeing how
the small bank in central Nebraska, you're going to have the last three gubernatorial candidates as depositors for the state.
I get that. And like, it's just that I am so used to seeing the financial sector, just capitalism, you know, our crony capitalist bullshit, economic system in general, and our government constantly favoring the rich and wealthy and entitled.
Welcome and, to the system.
And because the system works exactly as it's supposed to work, right? Like, it's not broken. Anytime someone tells me the system's broken, I'm like, no, bro, it ain't. It works the way it's supposed to. But like in this particular case, and in other cases like it, like I'm kind of Velcroed to that belief that, you know, in a hypothetical situation where that may not exist based on what you just said, which then kind of makes it a fallacy to talk about it. But, you know, they're just willing to bail out rich people. And the government looked at it and they were like, oh, it's a bunch of rich people. Mark Cuban's and, you know, Larry Summers are fucking on TV talking about, oh, we got to bail them out. We got to bail them out. We got to bail them out. Fed's got to act right now. And they're like, oh, okay, we're going to do exactly what our fucking rich fucking friends asked us to do. Even though they didn't bail out the bank, they looked at the depositors and they're like, oh, we got to help our friend, you know, Gavin Newsom, right? And like, maybe that's just me buying into the more right-wing narrative. I would say
they're going to look at each failure like this as an individual transaction, and they're going to say, hey, look, can we not guarantee this and set up a transaction with another bank to where they just one for one, you know, move everything over? And if we can do that quietly, like the other 100 bank failures per year happen,
right,
then we're going to do that. If they could have done that with SIVB, it would have happened very quickly. It would have happened the day before, you know, they had to declare insolvency. It would have happened very quickly.
So this one's different because it was noisier. Mm-hmm. And because they're probably, it seems like, I guess we'll find out if this is true.
And when they had to mark all those treasuries to market all of a sudden on a day that moved, that just so happened to move against them when they were selling into the market. It was kind of a shit day.
And it seems like there were some, what they call the tech bros, that kind of caught wind of this and like maybe like texted each other and like caused this to happen
and made it worse.
Yeah. And like, so that's kind of like what made it noisier. And obviously if there was some, you had the lady who was the risk manager who, you know, got a $1.7 million golden parachute, what, a year before the bank failed, and then they went without one, though they did retain her for part of that 1.7 was to retain her as an advisor. But like, you look at all this stuff and like, I am totally into the fact that there was probably some insider shit going on there, some semi, you know, quasi Martha Stewart shit going on where they're like, you know, somebody at the bank tells their boy, you better pull your money up out of here. You know what I mean? And that's what made it noisy. And that's why, like, Norfolk Southern, like, everyone's paying attention.
There was some corruption things going on, for sure. But
well, at the bank, heart, of course there was.
At the heart, why should workers at Roku miss payroll? Because of a bad chief risk officer decision. I mean, that's the kind of questions we're going to ask ourselves.
Well, to be fair, just to counterpunch that, Roku doesn't need $480 million to make payroll this week.
How do we know that? I don't know what their payroll is.
I would say that we could probably Google that pretty quickly and find out how many.
But they also have capital requirements for all the loans that they have.
Right, but that's different than people. You know, I'm.
What do you mean? What do you mean? Because if you miss all your capital and all your loans come due, you're out of business.
And then
everybody loses their job.
Well, everyone would lose their job, but I mean, theoretically, they'd know they're going to lose it and they'd get a severance.
Nope. They get nothing. You're illiquid. You're insolvent. You're gone. Roku's gone.
Well, obviously we have to research before we know the answers to that. And I don't have them, right? Like,
Somebody who has lent money to, who has written the paper for lending money to businesses capital requirements and the amount of coverage of liquid assets that you have to maintain, such as current ratios, if that drops below anything, and they mark those either on a weekly or monthly basis on the borrower balance sheet. If those mess up at all, the loan defaults, it comes due.
I see. Period. All right, so I have two last questions for you on this, then we'll talk for a second about inflation, then we'll roll you out of here. First one, should people be able to borrow from the Fed? You, me, at these, you know, why can't we just have a public centralized bank to where we can all do business? That was Hamilton's vision, was it not? I mean, he wrote in the Federalist Papers about his want for a national bank. We have a national bank. But the only ones who have access to it are the corporations. Is that good? Is that fair? Should we advocate for getting people elected? The Fed is will change that.
The Fed is a bank for banks.
Right. But should they?
I think you're more talking about should we have a banking system through the Postal Service or something along those lines?
Well, whether it's the Fed or a to-be-created Irish Swedes bank for the people, right, run by Bain. You know, it's for you, the people, you know, it's, is that something that we should advocate for on the progressive left to have, you know, cause you almost never hear AOC talked a little bit about a private bank, maybe a year and a half ago that fizzled out after 2 weeks. You know, is that an option that we should be looking, is that a characteristic we should be looking for in our candidates in the next cycle?
I think it's something that can be talked about. I don't think it's going to go anywhere because obviously of lobbying and corruption when it comes to that. I would love to see postal offices also be depository institutions and not lending institutions, maybe not lending institutions, but certainly depository institutions so that we can maybe have these get an institution available to the people that has no fees, no minimums, none of the lot of the games that said, you know, traditional financial institutions do with minimum, you know, bank balances and things like that.
Yeah.
So because the treadmill of the payday check, you know, shit is just killing people.
You mean the paycheck loan people? Are they still around? I didn't know they were still around.
Yeah, they are. Some are regulated to the point where they can only charge, you know, 40% APR.
They were charging 1,000% back in the day.
Yeah.
And of course they were only in, you know, poor neighborhoods. You'll never see a payday loan store in Beverly Hills.
No.
Because
we only that, but there's also check cashing and people that just don't trust the banking institution by itself, and I don't blame them, especially if they're a minority in the way they've been treated.
Right.
There's that. And if you take all that away and say, here's a depository institution that's not going to make any loans, what it's going to do is you're just going to buy 7-day repo paper, which is money that is lent out for 7 days alone. And that's it. So you're not going to have these long-term large losses when interest rates move. You're just going to have money that comes in, comes out on 7 days. And we'll pay you half of what we make on that. And it's all going to be government repo, period. And so you have this institution that people trust where they know it's not being lent out to, you know, sweetheart deals, that it's not being lent out to high risk deals.
Well, you know, as well as I
know, you have an instant huge infrastructure already built, the post office system.
Yeah, but see, here's the problem. I'm not disagreeing with you. I'm just brainstorming. What would my dad say? What would Tucker say? You know, he's, because unfortunately these people are influential. And, you know, you'd have Matt Walsh going on and doing a video about this. And it's they'll put together a team of people led by Newt Gingrich, I'm sure, and Steve Bannon find all of the dark, dirty secrets of the Postal Service, even the stuff that Trump did and, you know, with trying to corrupt the Postal Service during his election, and then trying to foster distrust within, you know, the Postal Service. And then you have to, you still have to battle back against that boogeyman of, you know, I don't want the government handling my banking. I don't trust the government. When ironically, when a private bank, this is what drives me out of my mind. When a private bank fails, we blame the government for however they handled it. But when the government screws up, we never blame anything but government, because everyone's so afraid of red scares. Right. But like,
which is funny because the Fed isn't even the government.
Yeah, but nobody knows that. Like people don't realize, they're convinced that like it's this
private company owned by the banks.
In reality, the way that I understand the Fed, it's a pseudo public, pseudo private entity.
No, it's a GSO. It's a government sponsored organization, which means it is a legal monopoly.
And paid for by taxpayers. It's a
private corporation that is owned by the banks.
Right. So it's that. How is my characterization wrong then?
It's not pseudo. It's just a GSO. It's like FINRA. FINRA is the regulatory.
I was being too generous with the word pseudo. It's like.
It's not a government organization at all. It's just government sponsored in that they're allowed to be a monopoly.
Right. But that's kind of the definition of a central bank, right? You know, a central bank would also, in essence, be a monopoly.
But it's not owned by the government. It's owned by
right. Yeah, it's not. Yeah, I get it. In the case of the Fed, it's not a government. It's not the government. Like,
it's not the government at all. A lot of people think it's
the government, but
it's the same thing as allowing the Cleveland Guardians to not allow another baseball team in the city of Cleveland.
Mm-hmm.
Because they can skirt antitrust laws that way because of the ruling in their favor. It's the same way with GSOs.
So I guess what I'm looking for here is this. If someone were to come to me and they would say, you know, I work a lot off common sense, right? Someone would come to me and say, I don't want a central bank because I don't trust the government. Government bad. You know, the things that I would, and this comes up with healthcare a lot too, right? I know one thing, the government is very good at writing checks. We all get our tax returns every year. And that's not to say that they're perfect, but when it comes to allocating money, the government does a very, very, very efficient job at that. So when the banks fail, we look to the government for bailouts. Now, obviously, I get the fact that people don't want to see the tax increases from that. I understand that fear. In the case of this bailout, or whatever you want to call it, I don't even know what we call it. If we're using backstop. Bailout as proxy, what's backstop. That? This call backstop. Thank you. Finding the name there is always difficult, but like in this case, you know, it's supposed to be paid for by the fees that the banks paid in for that, you know, for that protection.
And it will be.
Which of course they're charging us fees though for, right? Like that's why we pay minimum deposits and overdraft fees and, you know, all that type of stuff.
To a point.
Credit, you know, debit card transaction fees and all that. All
to
that
a jazz. Point. Yeah.
Well, to a point as in where, what am I missing?
The amount of fees that they charge comparatively to what.
Oh,
they
way pay. More. Yeah. 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 Okay. Yeah. No. Yeah. That much I knew already. Okay. I thought you were saying I missed a variable in that equation. Yeah. Oh, God forbid that they banks might make less profit. Then they'd have to fire the mealworm worker and only give the CEO a $15 million bonus instead of a $13 million bonus, because it probably would get higher. But what would be your elevator pitch to someone who said, taking what I said and maybe expounding upon it or saying, hey, Jason, what you just said wasn't a very good argument, to someone who says, no, I don't think that we should have a government sponsored bank or a public bank.
If I could show you the balance sheet of a very wealthy person, let's say not say Warren Buffett level, but say somebody that's got 50 million liquid.
Mm-hmm.
roughly 10 to 15 million of that.
Like you and me, you mean?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like roughly 10 to 15 million of that is going to be at treasury.gov.
Say that one more time.
It's going to be at treasury.gov. They're going to be buying direct treasury bills, T-bills, I-bills, treasuries from the government directly. The system's already there.
You're bringing up a good question. This just dawned on me. I've never thought about this before. Who holds the treasury?
The treasury is government.
Okay, so that's not connected to the Fed at all.
No.
That's just like
the Fed.
Andrew Hamilton's desk drawer in an office somewhere is the treasury.
The Fed buys the treasuries that the treasury buys some of the treasuries that the treasury produces. You people like you and me buy the others, and then some foreign ownership is allowed as well. Not very much. Sure.
Yeah,
I think that's
13% or something like that.
Yeah, it's pretty small.
Yeah, none to Venezuela, by the way.
As far as you and me and the banks are, what, 70 some percent of the treasury ownership is the average person.
You know, what's funny is that the U.S. does not allow any. I want to say it's 11 or 13%. I was reading that recently. Of foreign investment, it might have been a single digit number, but it's in the ballpark there. But when it comes to us playing that game with other countries, no such rules apply.
No, of course not.
Yeah, we can own 80% of another country's treasury in theory. Well,
that's because we play that game through the IMF.
Well, then we let our corporations do it.
That's a different discussion too. Well,
we let our corporations do it by proxy, you know, too. So. All right.
But that's a totally different rabbit hole.
Right. Okay. Well, that'll be the third hour of tonight's show.
that's tonight, the one where you need to get John Perkins on to talk.
Let's do it. I've been becoming more and more interested in talking about economics as I've started to understand a little bit more, because it was always something I never really paid too much attention to. My laser focus is on getting money out of politics and getting healthcare and, you know, avoiding social chaos in this country. Getting people the right to vote. Economics was never something that I paid too much attention to, you know, other than, you know, the classes I took in school and figuring that because I understand elasticity and propensity to save or spend, that I therefore understand everything. You know,
it's just so, simple supply and demand, bro. Simple supply and demand.
But you have no understanding economics.
To get back to the original question of your elevator pitch, I would just show a balance sheet of somebody that had 50 million liquid and be like, look, we already have a national banking system. The rich are using it. Why can't we democratize it to the rest of the world? Or the rest of our citizens.
So my response to that as Joe Schmo on the right would be, what are you talking about? We don't have a public banking system. That person who's liquid has their money in Chase or.
No, they don't. I would show them directly. It's at treasury.gov. You have to buy them through the treasury direct.
So, but do they get interest on that money?
Yeah. Of course, it's
oh, really?
It's bond. They're buying T bonds.
Oh, so you're talking about stock. You're talking about bonds and treasuries then.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I didn't think about the fact that a bond was literally that. Okay, I just didn't connect those dots.
If you go to treasury.gov, you can buy I bonds right now that are paying about 6.9%. Because those are the inflation adjusted bonds.
Okay. So I'm glad you said the word inflation there, because I want to segue to that real quick for the last couple minutes here.
But you have to have like $10,000 to open these accounts right now.
Hmm.
So sometimes $1,000 just depends.
So there's a barrier to access.
Barrier to access. But if we were to flood the gates with, say, 30 million unbanked or underbanked people through the post office system into this, and pay a team of, say, 150 people who know how to manage and allocate this amongst the various treasury bills, T-bills, T-notes, T-bonds, which are three different things, NI-bills, then you could actually, you know, the treasury system's already there. It's already being used by the wealthy. It's already a banking system that they use to go in and out of liquid assets. So what's the richer using it? Why don't you want to be able to use it? It's every question I've always asked anybody whenever anything gets opened up to the mass affluent or the masses is, I'm sorry, I don't understand why you're worried about getting more access to markets. I guess I don't understand, you know, why people would be afraid of that. And the private banks aren't going anywhere.
Sweet. It's because they're told to be afraid. Okay. I mean, I am in shock that I have to explain that to you.
but that is my elevator question is right. I would directly look at someone and be like, why are you afraid of having another option?
Yeah, because
no one's going to tell you have to go to the post office to do your banking.
Right.
You can still do it at Chase. You can still do it at Wells Fargo. However, there are about, for every one of you, there's probably another one or two people that have been screwed by the system and don't want to do it. And they actually sit in cash in their house.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's been great. Now, again, to segue back to inflation, because I just want to make sure that I don't lose my train of thought here. Where do you see, first of all, if you could just explain to the, I'm sure there's one or two right-wing folks in the chat here who believe that Joe Biden is not only the president of the United States and responsible for inflation, but also the president of Iran and Australia and Canada and Russia and Ukraine and every other country, and is responsible for global inflation. Can you just explain, you know, the U.S. government's role in global inflation? Like, we know that we have more to do with it than, say, you know, Kazakhstan, but how does the U.S. economy affect global inflation?
So there was a great paper out by the San Francisco Fed, division of the Fed, that came out and actually did a full-on attribution analysis as to where the inflation came from.
Right.
And roughly 7% was from wage increases.
I have these figures, actually. Hold on. I keep
6.8 or some stupid number like that.
It is 7.9% unit labor costs. 38.3% non-labor input costs, which is, you know, like supply chain, other stuff. And then corporate
53%
profit.
53.9%,
54% corporate profit.
Yeah.
You know, so yeah, we.
And how much of that was demand related? Oh, here's the other thing that 38%, right?
I just turned it off, but it was.
35%. Yeah. Let's just say it's 35, whatever. So when 2020 happened and into 2021, a seismic shift happened between the traditionally economic demand of the American consumer. Typically, 2/3 of our demand is services, 1/3 is goods.
Mm-hmm.
That flipped almost overnight in 2020. We went from that to 2/3 goods and 1/3 service economy, and we still haven't shifted back. Now, if you can imagine the amount of seismic shift in infrastructure you need to go from a mostly service to a mostly goods economy overnight.
Yeah.
You can kind of start to understand when we say it was a supply chain issue, we're underselling it.
Yeah, and working
in supply chain. Way much more than that.
Working in supply chain, I can assure you that this is definitely supply chain. I mean,
it's number one. Number two, we couldn't satisfy the goods demand mainly because a lot of the dock workers, you know, we were restricting hours, we were restricting people, we were restricting a whole bunch of things. There were the average wait time in the LA Harbor was what? Went from 2 weeks to
depending on the time frame, there was people literally jumping onto other boats and going home because they hadn't seen their family in 2 months. You know, like my terminal was, we did a lot of business at the Long Beach port, you know, which is basically what people call the LA port. It's technically Long Beach, but, you know, there's, and supply chain is like supply, our supply chain system is very robust, but at the same time, it is fragile. I mean, what's China's zero COVID policy has been highly impactful. You know, Ukraine, what's happening in Ukraine has been highly impactful on this. But also, you have, you know, a lot. If one piece of the supply chain breaks down, at, you know, I'm you can make any example you want. This microphone, you know, if I'm the company that produces this, this is the finished good that I sell, and I can't get the switches, or the, in the case that most people talk about is a microchip, but in this case, I don't think there's a semiconductor in this microphone, but you know, so I can't get the switch, or I can't get the port that we use to plug it into the USB-C because my supplier is gone out of business. The problem becomes we have all of these agreements with these, and I'm not saying these agreements are bad, but they attribute to the problem because if I have an agreement to buy my USB-C ports from Joe's USB-C port company and he goes out of business, I now have to go to someone else who I do not have a contract with. That price will be higher because I generally have a preferred buyer agreement with Joe's USB-C port company. And also I'm now taking stock from, you know, this is a Audio Technica. So now the guy who sells them to Yeti is selling to me and he doesn't have enough to fulfill his obligations to Yeti. And then you end up with a lack of supply, which of course raises the price.
But you also have the other situation in which in May of 2020, you had everybody working from home. Guess how many people wanted webcams versus how many were being produced?
Sure. Yeah. And that's why Netflix went through the roof and, you know, a lot of other Zoom, like their stock was just insane.
Yep.
You know, and real estate, corporate offices were closing down left and right.
Yeah, our office here where I am, it's 98% empty even today.
And in order to make up those heating and cooling bills, PG&E, ComEd, Texas Energy, whoever the fuck that is, what do? We can't show a loss. So I wonder who will pass that cost off to. You know, but then of course the right wing will just say, well, then it's the left's fault because they created COVID, right? So I mean, we can never get out of this, right? Like you have to realize we can never navigate our ways out of this conversation because when you can make dumb straw man or false yeah. create false dichotomies on a whim,
or just false premise.
Yeah, or false whatever, right? It becomes nauseating because you're like, it's always, you know, I overcome that one. And you're like, well, the real problem is the fatherless rate and we don't have Christian morals. Okay, so now we're back. Now we're back to that. But where do you see inflation going over the course of the next 3 to 6 months? And is the banking system in this country, these are different questions, but I kind of want to close with these two. Where do you see inflation going? And is our banking system stable? Like, I think those are like my last two wrap up questions. Like, should people be worried when it comes to banking? You can tackle those in either order.
I believe personally, and again, I have to give the caveat here. None of this is actually advice. This is all for educational purpose only. Well,
because you knew SVB was going to fail before it failed, right? You're Irish Swede. So of course you knew this. You just didn't tell us because you're part of the deep state. So we'll just get that out of there first, right?
Yeah, but all joking aside, I really should preface this that, you know, please talk with a financial advisor if instead of listening to me for advice on like investing and everything else. But because I can be wrong. As far as the banking system is concerned, I have full faith that the Fed will step in and stop anything from being cascading out of control. I have no reason to believe that Mr. Powell will throw the entire weight of the Fed behind any domino, whichever domino they don't want to tip. Whether it's the first, second, third, or fourth, they'll stick a stopgap in there somewhere. And the Treasury won't be there very far behind to help. So for me, our banking system, probably there will be some other failures, whether they're related, like Credit Suisse is just, that's unrelated because it's they've had scandal after scandal after scandal after scandal after scandal that they've had to recover from. So everything has its own context. Like SIVB is in no way related to Credit Suisse, and they're not yeah. related in instances. And the next round of bank failures will be due to something completely else that you didn't see coming, such as, a farm crisis or something like that, like what happened in the late 80s. So I think as far as my confidence in the banking system, nobody I know ran to the bank to take their deposits out or to move to a different bank. My money is with a major regional player, so... I didn't lose confidence where that was. It was just but mine is also public, so you also have a lot of transparency into what they do. So if you have the wherewithal to study the 10-Ks and Qs, which are the public filings for a public bank, you can actually get a pretty good picture of where your money is and what they're lending money to. So that's on that. As far as inflation, the sticky numbers.
Before you jump to that, though, wouldn't it be nice if Chase were to fail? Hypothetically speaking, most Americans have a Chase credit card or a Bank of America credit card or whatever. They also have money in those banks. Most of the common Americans have, $700-$800 in their savings in their checking account. But when in that same banking app. I owe more money to my Chase credit card than I do have in my Chase bank account. So if Chase fails, I get off from the credit card too, right? I don't have to pay it anymore. That's how that works, right, Sweet?
No, that's not how that works.
So wait, you're saying I lose the money in the account, but I don't. Oh, okay.
You keep your liabilities. You don't keep your assets.
Oh, God, we love capitalism so much. It's so amazing. So great.
Amazing. Sticky inflation is going to stick around. Sticky inflation numbers are going to be our wages, our cost of employment is going to keep things high, mainly because we don't have high enough immigration to fill the amount of positions.
Yeah, and immigration is another topic that I've been tackling a lot lately. It is absolutely insane. Like how culture war-y the immigration topic has become in this country over the last 5 or 7 years.
I don't care who comes, but what I do care is that they're allowed to bring their cuisine with them.
Oh yeah, for sure.
that's a requirement by me because we have a whole bunch of taco stands that are just like chef's kiss.
Yeah, it's touchy though because like I realize that we want immigration, but I also don't want to like brain drains are also not a good thing. You know what I mean?
Especially for the countries where they're coming from.
Right. So like it's touchy because we can't be like you can be America first, and I won't get mad at people, but America first doesn't mean America first; it means America only.
Then you find out the problematic nature of where America first came from. America first was the very first man, the very first group to use that as a mantra was the German American Bund Nazi Party.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then the KKK adopted it.
Yeah, it's, you know, you don't say.
it's America First is nothing more than a dog whistle.
They're every, well, but we're just, no, we're just woke. That's all. You know, we're
proudly wear that label. I woke to
we
me.
See racism in everything. We see a black cat and a white cat, and we figure, you know, the black cat must be oppressed because we're just woke. It sucks that we're always right because we know history. And like here, just quick funny point here. I find it super crazy that like, I forget the Larry, what's his face, who I was talking about before, Underwood or whatever his last name is.
Summers.
Yeah. Larry Summers. Thank you. Yeah. He, I don't know why I was thinking Underwood.
The dean of Harvard's economics department.
He's begging for us to bail out rich people. And whether you do or not, that's one thing. But at the same time, an hour before, tweeted out anti-student loan forgiveness. You know, it's like, that's absolutely absurd. Like, their bias is not even, they don't even try to hold their bias towards the rich and wealthy. You know? By the way, has Trump been arrested yet? He said he was going to get arrested Tuesday.
I don't know.
Yeah, I'm guessing that didn't happen. Because I don't hear guns going off down the street. All right. So Irish Swede, here's a question I have for you. When are you, why aren't you joining us more? Because we have to suffer through Tim. And when we have the Tim, it's like we have the mini Swede. Like we have Swede 2.0, like the discount edition. You know what I mean? Like we want the premium edition. We don't want.
You have the poli sci. You have the poli sci version, not the econ version. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Monday is a big day for me. That's my follow-up CT scan. As far as whether the subclavian bypass, which is right there, worked or not. If it did not work, that means I need to have a full thoracoabdominal incision and full aortic replacement done, which will be a very, very risky, very long recovery. The mortality rate for a thoracoabdominal full aortic replacement is in the full single digits. It's quite a hell of a procedure. They put you up on your side at a 15 degree angle. They cut you between the 8th and 9th ribs from here all the way to the back, and they crack you open like a can of biscuits. And then they go in from here, and then they replace you from the top of your arch all the way into your legs. And it's a, and as my surgeon told me, you've already beat 1 in a billion odds. So, you know, you might as well beat these too. And the other lucky part is I have Dr. Caselli working on my case. Dr. Caselli's mortality rate within his group in Houston is well below 1%. So there's that. But there's a whole host of other risks that go along with this that include, you know, paralysis and a whole bunch of other things. So for the next few weeks, I don't know what future holds, but Monday will tell us a lot. And you can imagine what it's like in the old Swede household, tension with the wife and the kids and everything else, because kids aren't stupid. They know something's up. They can feel it. And then obviously my wife and I are, you know, trying to deal with this as best way we can. I like to make the joke that my favorite college basketball team got a Hall of Fame coach. My other favorite college basketball team is in the Sweet 16. Nebraska got a new coach. I can't die. I got to see how all this all plays out.
Yeah, you got to see the next phase 5 of the Marvel movies, you know. Mm-hmm. Hey, we're anything we can do, you know, most of us don't believe in prayer. So, you know, but for those that do,
I don't turn it down.
Yeah. I wouldn't turn it down either, but because there's always that 0.1% chance that you might be wrong.
But the other thing is like, if I have to go through all this, and it likely, if they come out and say the gurgle wasn't fixed within the endograft, it'll have to be done pretty quick because I've already got a 5.2 centimeter aneurysm and they operate at 5.5. So there's not much room to go there. And so it'll be within the next few months. And the recovery time from that is anywhere between 3 months to 3 years. Like you're on your back.
Well, that's not a problem for Dig on America. We have resources. So we'll just put the camera on your ceiling. Okay. Just zoom it in. We'll have to watch you live stream as you use the restroom and stuff, but you don't care. You're here for the people.
Well, right? for the most parts of my recovery, I didn't have to get up to use the restroom, put it that way.
There's actually some positive to that. I am on an offside note. I'm in between houses right now. Right. So we sold our house in California. We're moving to Texas, but for the last 4 weeks and for the next 4 weeks, I'm staying at my parents' house. And I'm freezing my ass off in my mom's basement right now. But my grandma lives here. My grandma's 93 and she's a real pain in the ass. I love her to death, but she's not in good shape. She's got a lot of health issues and she's got the big bar, the handicap bars on the toilet seat. So there's the shower's hard to get into because we've installed bars on there for her, which is all fine. But when the conversation for it, and I am not lying to you, Swede, when the conversation around the house for 10 consecutive days is grandma's next bowel movement, it becomes, I almost wish that I didn't have to get up and share and wait for her to get out of the bathroom. I would welcome a catheter at this point and just stay in bed because it would be significantly less hassle to sit there and like, as if I'm going in there and I have to take a whiz and I hear her coming down the hallway slowly like a turtle, I'm like, I have to hurry up and get out of here because she has no time to, she can't wait for me to get out. Let's just put it that way. Right. So it's like, I know some listeners, it's gross, but whatever.
when you go through a full tons of mice
and only for you.
When you go through the full like anesthesia thing, your bowels shut down. And so the whole wake up process of your bowels post-surgery, even if it was an easy one, like my bypass was, takes months for your bowels to get right back to where they used to be. It's a long process.
I believe
You may not be constipated or anything like that, but man, you've got some issues that you need to work out.
Well, brother, we're going to be thinking and praying for you. We'll make sure that you're shirtless when you're on camera and we'll paint pecs on you so you'll look like Channing Tatum. We've got it all worked out. Like, Mikey's on this. Okay. So don't worry. And the doctors always also have to answer to Mikey, which I don't think they want to do. So they're going to have to work extra
hard.
I think
they would rather not have to answer to my wife.
No, I don't have the pleasure of knowing her yet, which you've done on purpose. So you've built the wall there. But yeah, so folks, we'll raid out of here real quick. Hold on 1 second here.
Actually, tons, it would be no hair because they give you a full body Brazilian doing what they do to me.
All right, so we're going to raid up out of here. So stay with us for the raid, please, and thank you. We'll go over to Echoplex Media. actually, you know what? We owe Progressive Brat a raid. So we'll go over to Ariana. She raided us a couple weeks ago. So we'll head over there. So the raid will start in about 10 seconds. Sweet, real quick, where can people find you?
They can't right now. All my channels are pretty much dead right now until we get all this stuff figured out. But you saw me type up in the chat earlier, the Swede, where the E's are threes. And You can find me on Twitter at sweet_Irish. If you really want to watch me yell at people on Twitter to keep my mind off what's going on. So pretty much where I'm at right now. So pretty much everything, all my YouTube, my Twitch, everything is pretty dead right now until we figure out what's going on. If it did work, look for a charity stream over Memorial Day for the John Ritter Foundation.
Let us know if we can do that, what we can do to help you out, brother. All right. So the raid has just taken place. So all we have left is YouTube people. So YouTubers, we will see you guys shortly. Sweet, take care. And thanks a lot, brother.
Big on America.